asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're asking the question, why does the stock market go up, with Brian Feraldi.
Yeah, you know, and I think the very next question folks might have, especially for beginner investors, is, will the stock market continue to go up? And I'll wager that our guest today would say that the world's got much bigger problems if that is not the case. But we are pumped to be joined by Brian Feraldi, whose journey into the financial realm has led to writing over 3,000 articles on stocks and investing for The Motley Fool. He's a YouTube star with millions of views, where he explains the ins and outs of individual companies and the market overall. And Brian's recent book, Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? That is what we're getting into today. This is going to be an investing deep dive as we seek to demystify some investing concepts that, folks listening, you may have always had questions about. Brian, thank you so much for joining How to Money.
Matt and Joel, awesome to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course, man. Yeah, glad to have this conversation. It's going to be interesting. It's going to get a little more nitty-gritty than we get sometimes on the investing front. So this will be fun. First question that we ask everybody who comes on, Brian, is what's your craft beer equivalent? What do you like to splurge on in the here and now while you're also, you know, socking money away into those investments? You're being smart, trying to build wealth for the future.
Well, I will say that my mouth really likes craft beer, but the rest of my body does not like the alcohol content of craft beer. So,
hey, they make non-alcoholic versions now. So
that seems like cheating, though. my splurge is I want as many ads out of my life as I possibly can. My whole family absolutely loves watching YouTube, and for years I resisted the urge to pay to have the ads removed, and then it was gifted to me to have the ads removed, and once I did that I was like, what was I thinking? Why didn't I just do this years ago? So I am one of those people that pays for YouTube every month because I don't want to see the ads.
I can 100% get behind that, because so Joel is the opposite, Brian, because Joel actually you reduced one of your subscriptions because you allowed yourself to be confronted with the ads. Whereas my family, Brian, we're more like you, where I'm just like, look, I'm willing to pay a few more dollars so that I don't have to sit through commercials while I'm watching a Prime video on Amazon.
See,
up on the TV.
So I think of it in a different way. I'm willing to pay less money to get the ads, but it's only because, like, oh, I probably wouldn't sign up for that streaming service otherwise. Like Hulu on Black Friday, 99 cents a month for the year. I'm like, cool, I'll sit through ads and occasionally watch something on Hulu, but I'm not going to pay the whatever $12, $14 a month it normally is to get Hulu, because I just don't care enough.
Yeah. So we all have different priorities.
We do, yes. No, I appreciate that your splurge is ad-free stuff.
So is it the sitting through the ads that you are against, Brian, or is it the just like the marketing and the relentless advertising and consumption that's kind of getting like shoved down our throats?
I just ignore all the ads when I see them. I don't think I've ever taken an action based on an ad that I've seen. It's more just just the annoyance. I mean, in my family, if we could only keep one streaming service, we would keep YouTube, like, across the board. Hmm. So we used YouTube enough that paying to have the ads removed is well worth it.
Well, you also have more mental willpower than Matt does, so I'll say that. he's always fallen prey to those Instagram ads.
For you, it's less the cultural aspect of it and societal aspect of it and more about the time.
The annoyance and the time.
Kind of makes sense, given what we're discussing today.
Yeah.
Investing. Brian, can you talk about how you got into investing? Like, were you a voracious reader? Were you like Warren Buffett? You started reading up on businesses?
And specifically investing education, like saying, oh, no, not only am I into it, but I want to, like, tell others about this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, but I also want to know, like, how, if you started trading by, like, investing, like, playing the stock market game, like, in elementary school.
Yeah, so I had very little exposure to the stock market growing up as a kid. I can tell you that my dad occasionally bought garbage penny stocks, and he would tell us about them. I remember he bought this one stock, and it was, like, supposed to be, like, working on a cure for cancer, ha ha ha, and that one didn't work out. He said, if this stock gets over $25 a share, I think it was $20 a share at the time, he's like, I'll buy you guys dirt bikes. So we would come home every day and, like, check the stock price and be like, please go up, please go up, please go up. And it never got over $25 a share, so we never got our dirt bikes. But aside from a few occasional run-ins like that, or hearing, scanning through the news and the boring business section coming up, or reading through the newspaper and throwing the business section away to get to the comics, my exposure to the stock market was very minimal when I was a kid growing up. In fact, when I graduated from college, that's when I really started to even know that, like, the stock market was a thing that you could invest in. I always heard that, like, rich people put money into the stock market for some reason, but it was never explained to me, even in college and high school, what the stock market was, why rich people put money into it. I'd never seen a chart that showed, like, the long-term returns of the stock market. So I didn't learn about any of that stuff until after I graduated from college.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and you're familiar, I'm sure, with the stock market game, though. A lot of kids did play it in high school, and it was like you'd pair off, or you'd individual sort of thing. You pick a couple of stocks and you'd see, well, who won at the end of 6 weeks or something like that, which is just a terrible, really the worst way to teach kids about pick a couple of individual ones. Let's have a really short time frame and see who wins. Right. And that's clearly not the best way to think about investing in stocks. How did you then start to get that education? Because obviously you didn't receive it until, you know, later on in your 20s, I guess. Where did it come from, and then where did the passion develop to teach others?
So I think I was a born saver. I always had the gene in me that wanted to save money and build up a cash pile. I've always just had that innate as my personality. Once I graduated from college, for me this was 2004, my dad, as a graduation present, handed me a copy of a book that was very popular at the time, and it's still popular to this day, called Rich Dad.
I thought you were going to say Poor Dad. Dirt bike.
A dirt bike, yeah. That would have been way better.
Finally.
Yeah. Right, finally, is true. We still razz him about that. Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. It was, and I got that book and I devoured it in like 48 hours. Like, I just picked it up, and it was the first time in my life that I was introduced to concepts like everyone's in business for themselves. The rich think differently about money than the poor and the middle class. You can become rich in one generation. The rich buy assets. The rich compound their wealth, etc. And those were all brand new concepts to me at the time. And I just became instantly enamored with all things related to money, personal finance, and investing. Now, today, I kind of look back at that book, and there are many parts of the book I disagree with today. I don't like his penchant for using tons of leverage and investing in gold, and he was like a big fan of penny stocks. That stuff is nonsense. But the mindset was the important thing that I got out of that book. And then that kickstarted a love affair. So I read a ton of his other books, and that led me to learn about books that were about investing in the stock market. So I read books by The Motley Fool, aka the Gardner Brothers, by Peter Lynch. I started to learn about Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and I just became a voracious reader of everything that I could find related to money and investing. And my first foray, or my first desire to invest my money was was I thought I was going to do it so with real estate. This was, you know, 2004, 2005 at the time, which was like the peak or the very peak of the real estate bubble of the 2000s. And thankfully, I knew enough to do analysis on houses to be like, these numbers don't make sense. Like, there's no way I can charge enough rent to cover the mortgage, let alone make a profit for myself. In addition, you need a lot of capital to get started in real estate, just to put a down payment on a house. So that kind of turned me off about the real estate industry, even though there's lots of great reasons to invest in real estate if that matches your personality. I kind of learned from me that does not match my personality. And then from there, I discovered the stock market, and that was just a much better fit for my personality when it comes to investing.
I love that. So I totally agree with what you're saying about Kiyosaki and just sort of the change in mindset, because I feel like that's my biggest takeaway. The fact that, man, I am all of a sudden looking at the world differently now. How is it that you can live like the rich do?
And just be careful following him now, because he's now predicting a crash every couple of months. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to just call short on everything.
Yep.
Eventually he'll be right, right?
Broken clocks,
one of these
right?
days he will. But I mean, is this shift in mindset basically why you consider the stock market like the greatest wealth creation machine of all time? It's sort of like looking at it through the lens of ownership as opposed to maybe just consumption?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I first started to learn about the stock market, you know, there's a great book called Stocks for the Long Run by Jeremy Siegel. I don't know if I've ever read it, but right on there, one of like the classic pictures that is in that book is 200 year returns of the U.S. stock market, the U.S. bond market, gold, the dollar, and a couple other things. And when you look at that, it is just clear as day that the stock market is the asset class to hold for the long term. I forget the exact numbers, but it was like over like 200 and something years, one single dollar invested in the U.S. stock market became worth $2.5 million. Dollars. Like the returns are just insane. And if you look at it compared to bonds or bills or cash or gold, it just blows every other asset class away. Now, I didn't know a key thing that I learned is I learned that, okay, the stock market for some reason goes up and for some reason makes people wealthy. Like, I understood that historically it had done so, but it was really on my own outside of books that I kind of pieced together why the stock market went up and what was the forcing function that caused the market to create wealth for the people that owned it.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think from the outside looking in, if you grew up kind of like you did, kind of like I did, no exposure to the stock market, My dad wasn't even investing in penny stocks. Like, there was zero investing going on until later on in his life, like putting money into the 401k finally. But I think most people think, oh, stock market is kind of like going to Vegas. It's kind of like gambling. But no, talk about the mechanisms that make the market go up. And I kind of want to get in a little nitty gritty here too, Brian, because this is what you do in the book. You're almost giving like a primer sort of education. What's even a stock? Can you talk about what is a stock and why does a stock go up and why do you want to own stock?
Yep. These are really important questions to ask, because so many people have heard the term stock market and they throw it around like it's just common knowledge that people understand what those two words mean. And I don't think that many people understood what those words mean, because I didn't know what the stock market was, even though I'd heard the term hundreds of times in my life. So let's take them into their components. So let's start with stock. What is a stock? A stock is simply fractional ownership of a corporation. That's it, okay? So in the United States, if you buy a house, the way that we have record keeping about who owns what real estate is with a deed. You buy real estate and you're given a piece of paper that says this parcel of land and this structure belongs to this person. Well, with a corporation, that deed is a stock. But instead of there being one piece of paper and one owner of a piece of land, with a corporation, there can be thousands or millions or billions of pieces of paper that represent partial ownership of that corporation. And if you own one of the stocks in a company, you have a permanent legal claim on the assets and future profits of that corporation. So that's all that a stock is. It's a piece of paper, or nowadays a digital record keeping, that says who owns how much of corporations.
That's pretty cool.
To think that it may not be very much, but yeah. But it certainly it's legit. It certainly
makes it feel more real, more tangible, instead of just kind of like, oh, I've got investments somewhere in the ether stock market. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, oh no, there's something tangible.
There's actual companies. Yeah. Yeah. So the part two of that question, Brian, what is it that actually drives prices up? I know this is the name of your book. It's basically like your life's work, but you've got 3 minutes to explain why the stock market goes up.
Yeah, sure. Go. Yeah. I wrote a whole book on the subject, but give me the 10-second version first. Sure. Well, okay, but let's back up. We talk about stock. What is stock? What is market? Let's look at the second word of that.
Okay.
So if you've ever been to a farmer's market, that is just where food buyers go to exchange with food sellers, right? That's what a farmer's market is. A stock market is just a place where stock issuers, aka corporations, go and meet with stock buyers, aka investors, and they exchange with each other. Instead of money for food at a stock market, it's money for shares in a corporation. So that's what a stock market is. Now, to understand why the stock market goes up over periods of time or even fluctuates day to day, you have to understand, well, why are stocks worth anything at all? Why would I go out and pay a few $100 to buy one share of Microsoft? What am I even buying? I know I'm giving up $400. What am I getting in exchange? When I buy a stock, as I said before, I am buying a fractional ownership of that corporation. So in Microsoft's case, Microsoft has a few billion shares outstanding. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's in the billions. Microsoft, the corporation, is worth something like $2 trillion, or it might be $3 trillion at this point. So the value of Microsoft, the whole company, is currently worth about, let's just say, $3 trillion. And the number of shares that are outstanding, the number of shares that exist to have that legal claim of ownership of that $3 trillion, let's just say for easy math that was $10 billion. So if I buy one of those shares, I am buying one ten-billionth of all of Microsoft's assets and a legal claim on one ten-billionth of all of Microsoft's future profits.
All right, now you're making it sound a little puny, Brian.
Well, if you divide by 3 trillion, you know, it actually becomes a decent sized number. So if I'm buying a share of Microsoft, what I am doing is I have a legal claim on a portion of Microsoft profits, both now and in perpetuity. If Microsoft produces more profit 5 years from now, and 10 years from now, and 20 years from now, just like it has over the last 50 years since it was founded, by turn, the value of my claim on those profits will increase, because the claim on those profits, the number of claims are staying steady or even declining over time, but the total profits that are being generated are increasing. So that's why a share of Microsoft is worth anything at all, because you're buying a legal claim on that company's future profitability.
Okay.
So to answer your question, why does the stock market as a whole go up? It's that collectively, all of the companies that are in the stock market, and there are thousands of them, are working together to gradually increase their profits over time. And as those profits increase, so does the value of the legal claim on those profits.
Yeah. So it's, you said working together, but they're actually kind of working individually. But then as all of them are publicly traded, that's the sense in which the index is working, functioning. When you buy an index fund, why it goes up over time, because all of those individual companies are doing the same thing, trying to create better products and services, reach their customer, increase their profitability levels, right? And then we all benefit because we own little slices and dices of that corporation. Okay, overall, because we live in a free enterprise system where companies are allowed to do this and really incentivized to do this to their own profit, what is it that makes the stock market go down? And what's up with the daily changes that can happen in the stock market? Because something like an NVIDIA stock price or something can be up 20% one day, down 10% the next day. And people are like, that's what makes it feel like gambling to a lot of people, I think. They're like, I get maybe the overall stock market going to go up thing, but what is going on in the interim? Yep.
Absolutely. And this is what confused me about investing when I first started. When you look at stocks for the first time, or you open up the stocks app on your phone that comes pre-built in, to me, it just looks like a random number generator. Right? You're like, this stock is up 1%, that stock's down 1%, this stock's up 3 points, that one's down 5. The next day it reverses. Like, if you don't have the ability to look at a longer term trend, if you only looked at day-to-day prices, you would think that stock prices are completely based on gambling and random movements. And in the short term, the stock market is a random number gambling machine. There's no telling what is going to happen to the price of any stock or any asset or any security over a short period of time. One way to think about the stock market is it's just a live, ongoing auction where buyers and sellers are meeting and they're exchanging with each other. And the eagerness of the buyers is compared to the eagerness of the sellers at any given time. And whichever party is more eager to make that transaction happen controls the short-term movement, the price movement of that asset. So in NVIDIA's case, if they report earnings, they come out, let's just say Wall Street believes, okay, NVIDIA is gonna do $1 billion in profit this quarter. And then NVIDIA comes out and says, hey, we did $1.4 billion in profit this quarter. Well, that is significantly more profit than they were expected to. So in that case, the eagerness of the buyers to buy NVIDIA stock would increase dramatically. At the same time, the willingness of the sellers to sell their NVIDIA stock would decline because NVIDIA is now doing better than it was expected to. And the result of those two things would be, well, demand goes up, supply goes down. What happens to the price? Goes up. So that's what controls short-term price movements of stocks. It's simply the collective emotions of the buyers and the sellers in a market at any given time, which is exactly why when people tell you they can predict stock prices, or they use technical analysis to show you what the price target of a stock is being, what they're actually saying is, here is going to be the collective mood of all of the market participants on this particular point in time, which is a ridiculous thing to try and predict, because I don't know what kind of mood I'm going to be in an hour.
That's right.
How could I possibly predict the collective mood of all market participants around the world at any given period of time?
Well, I can predict your mood, Brian, based on what you ate for breakfast. So if you tell me that, then I'll be able to inform you what it's going to be like in an hour. Just let
there
me
you
know.
Go. Okay. English muffin, egg, and hummus.
You're in a fantastic mood, Brian.
Yeah, no,
we can just tell.
Very happy.
I mean, it makes me think of like electron microscopes, and you see some of these images of something bizarre, something random zoomed in, and it's insane. Like it looks like an extraterrestrial landscape, but then as you zoom out, you're like, oh, that's just like the tip of a ballpoint pen. And we'll kind of get to timelines and timeframes a little bit later. And actually, we've got more. I mean, we're discussing right now kind of some of these larger scale macro aspects of the market and how it works, but we're going to get very specific. We're going to talk about things like dividend stocks and even individual stock investing. We'll get to all of that and more right after this.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to PolicyGenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's PolicyGenius.com. All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with Brian Feraldi. We're talking about why the stock market goes up, and we're getting into the nitty-gritty here about how the stock market works, what a stock is. We talked about that. But Brian, you were just touching on emotion. In a recent newsletter, you talked about how introverts are naturally better investors, which felt like a personal attack, I'm not going to lie, to me as an extrovert. But fill me in. What's up with that? Why are introverts better investors, in your opinion?
Generally speaking, and by the way, I'm an extrovert on the introvert extrovert scale. But that referenced a study that came out that talked about when you are investing, your emotions will play an enormous role on how well or how poorly you do as an investor. All of us are naturally born to be horrible investors. That is an innate thing that all of us are born with. We are naturally drawn to follow the crowd, to get our social cues and our emotional cues from other people around us. That's a very critical thing to us surviving in the wild 10,000 years ago. However, so many of the natural things that we want to do as humans, our natural emotions, will lead us to do precisely the wrong thing when it comes to investing. This is why so many people get interested in investing or want to start investing after the market has gone up tremendously, after they've seen stock prices go up, after they've heard their neighbor brag about how much money they made in the market, or they made buying fill in the blank cryptocurrency, right?
It's FOMO right there.
Huge FOMO. It's a very real thing. And especially if you don't know what you're doing, you naturally want to invest when the market is the riskiest. And the market is the riskiest after it has gone up tremendously. And conversely, after the stock market has declined and tough economic times are here and people have been, your friends and family have been laid off, and there's doom and gloom forecasts about the state of the economy, and the stock market has declined huge and your net worth has gone down, that is precisely the time when it is best to invest. But it takes an incredible emotional fortitude to buy when everybody else around you is in a malaise, and there's mm-hmm. doom and gloom calls about the next recession of being there.
So is it that introverts are less swayed by the crowd?
That is a component of it. Introverts, generally speaking, are more introspective. They focus more on data. They are generally less swayed by their own internal emotions, and they generally don't get energy from other people that are participating in the market. So they are, to your point, they are less swayed, generally speaking, by the emotions that they see other people experiences, where extroverts are hypersensitive to the emotions of other people, and they generally get more excited about investing when markets are at their peak, and less excited about investing when markets are at their bottom. But of course, that's a generalization, and there are plenty of exceptions.
But it also kind of makes sense. I think in that same newsletter, you mentioned that like the majority of Americans are extroverts. And so the fact that we do see those tendencies in the market, it kind of explains it. But it also makes it almost sound like that a psychopath would be the best investor.
Psychopaths would be fantastic investors. In fact, many of the best investors of all time, many of them have almost personality disorders that cause them to just focus on the data and ignore everything else. In fact, I know an investor, a successful investor who exclusively looks for companies that are founded by people with Asperger's.
Wow. That's an interesting tact right there for sure. But I bet it pays though to a certain extent, because you are able to eliminate a lot of the noise, but simultaneously maybe invest a little more in your PR department.
But absolutely.
Elon
Musk is definitely does not have a normal personality, but man, has he created shareholder value.
It's just like what he said in Saturday Night Live.
Were you expecting a normal dude?
Exactly.
Me a normal dude.
Like what you're pointing at here is the fact that like our humanity, it just throws this massive wrench into things. It reduces our chance of success. So with that in mind, can you talk about ways to mitigate that liability? How do we keep ourselves from making poor investment decisions?
The first thing you need to do is study yourself. Know your own personal investing behavior. And the best way, the really only way that you can figure that out is by knowing your personality, and other people are oftentimes better judges of your personality than you are, but really audit your behavior in past market periods. How did you feel in 2020 when everything was going up, and the riskier the asset class, the more money you made? And conversely, how did you feel in 2022 when the exact opposite of that happened, when everything went down and the riskier the thing, the more money you lost? If you were a rabid buyer in 2020 and a rabid seller in 2022, you are not cut out. Your personality is not cut out to be an investor. And you need to take actions that will prevent your actions that you want to take from harming your long-term financial picture. Mm. And the easiest way to do that there is to just dollar cost average into index funds. And just take your emotions completely out of the equation by setting up automated systems that do all of the buying and all of the investing for you without you having to think about it. Now, conversely, if you were the type of the person that was fearful and scared and started selling stocks in 2020, but you were excited and gleeful and buying stocks at the end of 2022, then you have the personal makeup to be a fantastic investor, and you could be more active and more tactical with how you deployed a capital. So it's really about auditing yourself and then setting up systems to make sure you don't harm yourself.
All right, you mentioned index funds there, and for a lot of personal finance advice, typically goes in that direction. It's like, listen, index fund and chill. It's pretty simple, dollar cost averaging with your paycheck. For most people, it's super doable. And it's also not something they have to put a lot of thought into. How do you know, but I know you invest in index funds, Brian, but you also invest in individual stocks. How does someone know whether or not investing in individual stocks makes sense for them? And I guess I would say the homework to be an index fund investor is pretty limited. You can figure that out in
30 seconds.
30 seconds. But really, like, even if you want to be astute, like, hey, let's just say read a book or two and do, you know, 10 hours worth of podcast listening, and boom, you have an understanding of why you're taking this approach. When you move into the individual stock investing arena, though, there's probably a lot more homework that needs to be done, and it's a lot more ongoing homework too. So how do you know if you're cut out to be an individual stock investor?
Yep. Real simple test. Does doing the homework interest you? Period.
If the answer
is no, which is a completely acceptable answer, that would put you in the 99% of people who is not interested in learning about investing and has no interest in cracking open SEC filings or listening to investor conference calls or learning accounting. If those activities put you to sleep, do not buy individual stocks, period. But if you are one of those weirdos like me that literally enjoys reading 10Ks, listening to investor conference calls, digging into financial statements, analyzing businesses, if those activities interest you and you will do them on your own naturally for the sheer joy of the process.
The sheer joy of it.
Then you should consider putting a portion of your portfolio into individual stocks.
That being said, you do some individual stock investing. About how much time, Brian? I'm curious to know about how much time you spend. Granted, some of this you don't consider work.
Joy-filled hours.
Because this is also, you kind of like blends into your recreational entertainment time as well. But about how much
slash
time would
you
say?
Slash my career.
And your career, yeah. But how much time do you think you spend researching stocks that you want to invest in?
So at this point, it's probably 10 to 20 hours a month. That might sound like a lot. That's not a lot. There was a time period previously when I was brand new to investing, and I would devote far more time to that because I was learning accounting, learning how to read SEC filings, learning how to develop a checklist, studying investors. So I have done that work of becoming an investor very deeply over the last 20 years, and I have spent time building and crafting the portfolio that I have today over the last 20 years. Now I am largely in maintenance mode with my portfolio. What I'm attempting to do when it comes to my portfolio is essentially build my own index fund. Build my own fund of handpicked individual securities that I want to own, and then I voraciously hold those companies for better or for worse. Okay. And I largely let the companies now do the work of growing my wealth.
You're picking these companies based on long-term metrics, right? So you're not just kind of saying, oh, I think that new product's going to launch, those new Apple Vision Pro goggles are going to launch. This is going to be the thing that makes or break this company. So I'm jumping in. You're thinking more about the 10, 20 plus year horizon for a lot of these companies. Or what other metrics are you considering? What makes it to the point where Brian Feraldi's dollars go to buy, you know, some stock in an individual company? And you mentioned before, I think in one of your newsletters too, how you didn't used to take valuation into account as much, but now you do. Now you view that as a more important parameter, which makes sense because even if, like, let's say a company is great, well, at some point too, and you believe they have long-term value, they still might be, the stock might be too expensive.
Yeah, my valuation is, we could do many podcasts just about valuation. But you are correct that generally speaking, over the last, call it 14 years, basically after in the wake of 2008, during the period where interest rates were zero, the lesson that I learned was de-emphasize valuation. Significantly de-emphasize valuation as part of your research process. And that was a lesson that I had to really learn because that goes counter to my nature as just a human being. Now that interest rates are back to normal, my current view on valuation is that you should emphasize valuation. So it's not that I didn't pay attention to valuation. I just gave it significantly less weight in my process. But now that that's reversed, now that interest rates are back to being 4 or 5%. And so I think valuation is more important today than it was even 3 years ago.
Okay.
But you asked about my research process. I'll just tick down my investing checklist. I hope this doesn't bore people too much. But There are several different categories that I look for when I'm researching an investment. So I always start with a look at the company's financial statements, multiple years of financial statements. And I want to know things like, what's the trend with revenue? What's the trend with margins, gross margin, operating margin, net margin? What's the returns on capital? What's the free cash flow versus earnings per share? And are those two things divergent? If so, why? What's the competitive advantage? What's the source of competitive advantage? What's the direction of the competitive advantage? What's the long-term growth trajectory of the business? Is it growing organically or is it growing through acquisitions? Is there operating leverage in the business or is that behind the company? What's the relationship between the company and its customers? Are purchases one-off basis or are they a repeat purchase business? Is the demand for the company's products cyclical and it follows the up and downs of the economy or is it recession-proof and you're buying it no matter what's going on? Who's running the company? How much stock do they own? What do employees think of the company? Is it mission driven? How many customers do the company get revenue from? Do the company pay a dividend? Does the company buy back stock? Does the company consistently outperform Wall Street's expectations? So those are the main categories that I look at. And I basically have a checklist that whenever I'm researching an investment, I go right down my list and just give it a score. And at the end of that scoring period, which typically takes me on a new idea 90 minutes or so, I get a feel for, is this company a good match for my investing personality? And if it is, I'll consider adding it to my portfolio. And if not, on to the next idea.
So I think there's a lot of nerds that might be listening to you and they're thinking, yes, yes, like every time as you're going down your checklist. And I'm going to kind of loop back to what you said as to a question someone should ask themselves if they're considering getting into single stock investing. And that's whether or not they enjoy the research. Do they enjoy the homework part of it? And what would you say to somebody who might be nerding out as they hear you say all of these things? But just because you have an interest in those things doesn't necessarily mean that this is a good fit or that you will be successful at it. Because like if you look at like the S&P over the past 20 years, you're looking at close to 10% annualized returns. But the average investor, you're looking at something like a little over 3% when you get somebody who's getting in there, they're doing a little bit of research, they're interested in it, but that doesn't necessarily lead to outsized returns. At what point does someone give it a go when they could just totally kick back and find an index fund with a 0% expense ratio and pretty much guarantee that they're going to outperform what the average investor would be receiving?
Totally. If you're going to go through this process of buying individual stocks and managing your own portfolio, is absolutely imperative that you measure your returns compared to the alternative. And the alternative is just index and chill, right? So if you are, you must measure your performance of your criteria to an index so that you can tell if all this effort you're going through is worth it. Or are you costing yourself wealth because you are outthinking yourself and you're not tracking your results properly. So it's very important to do so. But I would say if somebody is interested in individual stock selection, people tend to have a all or nothing mentality when it comes to indexing or individual stocks. There's no such parameters. There's nothing wrong with putting 90% of your capital into index funds and using that 10% of it or 20% of it, whatever you want, to buy individual stocks. And also, if you don't want to do a lot of homework, but you still want to own, if there's like three companies that really interest you, great. Put 80% of your capital into index funds, put the remaining 20% into those three companies, and that will dramatically cut down on the amount of research and homework that you have to do. So yeah. I personally have all of my retirement funds in index funds. They're just there purely for simplicity, and they're just growing. And then all of my taxable income, all my taxable assets are in individual stocks. And that's a split that matches my personality. But in the case that I bomb on my individual stock selections, I still have those boring index funds in the background doing their thing.
All right, you don't have to give me specific numbers, but how have you done then as an individual investor? And like, is the proof in the pudding? Like, are you like, you know, Brian Bicep Flex Feraldi over there with your individual stock returns. Like, and at some point, if you continue to underperform, because like we talk about these, there's always a new study coming out saying that stock pickers are underperforming the market on average, especially the longer the time duration. So, yeah, how have your returns been? Again, not trying to put you on the spot, but how have your returns been versus kind of the stock market average?
If you give me 2 seconds, I will log into my brokerage account and I'll get you a precise answer. But I am outperforming. So my benchmark is the S&P 500. That's a very common benchmark to go after. And essentially, if I was not investing in individual stocks, what would I be doing with my capital? AKA, the S&P 500 is the bogey that I am personally trying to beat. Over the last 10 years, excuse me, over the last, 12 years now, I say 12 years because that's when I changed brokers to the broker that I have now. And tracking data beyond that 12 years is a little bit tricky, but I have outperformed the S&P 500 by about 230%.
Ooh. Joel's going to ask how he can buy into that.
Yeah, would you like to manage my money for me? Fund?
So that is a very good question. And I think this is worth highlighting. I refuse to manage anybody else's money. And I think it is incredibly challenging to manage somebody else's money. And this is why, if you look at a lot of studies come out that say mutual fund managers underperform index funds, like across the board, right? That is in part because of the fees, plain and simple, right? The fees are a massive drag on index funds. But managing other people's money is way harder than managing your own money.
Because you're dealing with the emotions of dozens and dozens of people as opposed to one person.
You have an extra factor that you have to think about, and that's that you're not making investment decisions in order to maximize the long-term wealth of the mutual fund. You are making investment decisions to maximize your argument that you could make to investors in that fund to give you more money. Because how mutual funds managers make money. They don't make money by outperforming the index. They make money by gathering assets. So a fund with $1 billion in assets, all things held equally, will make more money than 10 times more money than a fund with 100 million in assets, regardless of performance. So what asset managers, their job, their actual job isn't to outperform the market. Their job is to do activities that gather as many assets as possible. So they will take actions that maximize their ability to retain and attract assets, regardless of how that impacts the shareholders of their fund. So this is just the principal agent problem in full display. And I think I'm a pretty decent investor. There's no way I would get these returns that I have if I was managing other people's money. No way.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I appreciate you pointing that out. Okay. I'm not saying that the front end work is easy, but I would imagine it's easier to identify companies that meet a lot of those metrics that you mentioned. Hey, okay, yeah, Amazon 15 years ago. This is going to meet a lot of my metrics, and I'm pretty sure I want to invest in this company. How do you know, and how are you keeping track of whether or not the company is still on the same track? For instance, and it's not just necessarily reflected in the stock price, but Tesla's not doing so hot right now. They were outperforming any other car company because people valued them more like a tech company. How do you know at what point, wait, it's lost its mojo, time for me to sell? Because that actually seems like the harder part of the equation when you start investing in single stocks.
You are absolutely correct. Knowing when to sell is 10 times harder than knowing when to buy. And this is one reason why index investing works so well, is because the reason that the time to sell an index is never, right? The stocks come in the index and stocks leave the index. The individual holdings of the index go up and down, but the index is constantly replenishing itself with the biggest, most innovative, strongest, most profitable companies of the day. So in large part, that decision to sell is largely taken out of the equation. However, I do have criteria that I personally have for when I will sell, and I'm happy to tick through a few of them, but the number one reason I sell is I was wrong. I had a thesis for a company. This company's gonna do great. This company's gonna capture this market. Data come in that clearly showed that the company did not capture the market. The stock has typically been pulverized at that point, and my thesis for owning that stock was just flat out wrong. That's reason number one. Reason number two, accounting irregularities. If a company comes out and says, we have to restate our financial statements that you've been making these decisions on, I can't trust anything about the company. Mm. Cultural deterioration. So employees start to leave that company, or a founder leaves that company, or a new management team comes in and you see Glassdoor ratings on that company really start to go downhill. That, I think, is a reason to sell. And then finally, my favorite reason to sell is I want to spend the money in my real life, AKA the reason we invest in the first place. So I've sold stocks to pay for home renovations, and I've sold stocks to buy a car. I've sold stocks to pay off my mortgage. Things like that are perfectly valid reasons to sell, even if those stocks then go up after you sold them. That's perfectly fine, because the whole reason we invest is to live a better life.
That's right. No, yeah, boiling it down in so many ways to kind of the most important things, and you're right, we're human. And so the goal is not to see the numbers go up on a screen in perpetuity. The goal is to also enjoy some of those dollars in the here and now. We got a few more questions to get to with you, Brian, including just like, okay, how do we actually get the ball rolling and get started? We'll get to just a few more questions with Brian right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach.
Yeah, we do.
Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Now we're back from the break with Brian Feraldi about why the stock market goes up. And Brian, just before the break, you're talking about selling stocks. in order to use that money in real life. Like, again, that's the entire point. Is that why folks oftentimes will gravitate towards dividend stocks? Because they don't have to sell it? You're talking about how it's like 10 times harder to decide when to go ahead and make that call to sell. But with dividend stocks, oh, you never have to sell. And so even though the performance of those companies or those stocks may not be quite as high, is that the emotional hang up? Is that what it is? The fact that they can draw an income from that company, from those stocks, without having to actually sell it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Let's back up. What is a dividend? A dividend is when a company generates profit and it chooses to take a portion of that profit and give it directly to its shareholders as a cash payment. And there's a ratio that you can look at between the dividend per share that a company pays and its share price. And that ratio will tell you the yield that a company pays for owning that stock. Kind of like you would have a yield if you put money into a savings account at a bank. So there are investors out there that exclusively look at companies that pay dividends. And paying a dividend is a luxury that only strong, mature, financially stable companies can really afford to do to their investors. So just by starting out and saying, I exclusively focus on dividend companies, you are eliminating a whole bunch of the investable universe. And by definition, these tend to be stronger, more financially stable, more financially disciplined capital return machines. And dividends are incredibly enticing because, as you said, you don't have to sell. You realize an income stream from your investment. And if the company does well, you can also earn capital appreciation from that stock. And, oh, by the way, that dividend can actually be increased over time, which can really help to compound your wealth. And if you really want extra points, you take those dividend payments that you receive and you reinvest them into assets, and that can really turbocharge your return. So there's nothing wrong with being a dividend investor. It can be a very attractive way to invest.
The downside, though, of a company that pays a big dividend is that maybe they're not reinvesting in the company. So talk to me maybe about that trade-off between, ooh, juicy dividend versus, wait a second, they're not doing enough to invest in the company and to kind of be more creative on the entrepreneurial front, I guess, with and where this company could go in the future.
You're absolutely right. If a company is paying out a dividend, by definition, that company no longer has access to that cash that it's paying out to the shareholders, and that management team's no longer can use that cash to increase the value of the enterprise. By and large, when a company generates a profit, there's a handful of things that the management team can do with that profit. They can do nothing, and they can just build up their cash balance at their bank. They can reinvest in their business. So they can hire engineers to build a new product. They can hire more salespeople. They can open up stores, or they can open up new geographies to sell their products into. So that would be reinvestment, generally speaking. They can buy back their stock. So by buying back their stock from investors, they reduce the number of legal claims that there are on their earnings in perpetuity. And that increases each existing shareholder's claim by simply shrinking the number of claims that are out there. Company can also pay down debt if it has any debt at all, which can de-lever the company's balance sheet. And the final thing is that if none of those four are attractive, is just give the cash to shareholders. Depending on what type of investor you are, and importantly, the stage of development that the company is, management teams tend to pull those levers in different orders. To your point, if a company is paying a dividend, by and large, that's kind of like management admitting, we have no good ideas of what to do with this money. You take it, shareholder. And that doesn't mean that the company isn't innovating and isn't growing. I mean, Apple. Apple's paid a dividend now for like 8 or 9 years. Apple is spending more money than ever on research and development each year, but the company is so insanely profitable that it can fund all of that research, fund new developments, buy back stock, and it still has cash left over to pay a dividend. So it's not pure mutually exclusive. But to your point, when you are making a capital allocation, a dividend decision, you are by necessity pulling money away from other ventures.
Yeah, they can pay those dividends and they still have money left over to have billions in the bank well.
They're like one of the few companies that can take the D, all the above approach.
Okay, Brian, let's round this out with a little bit of how-to. It's in the title of our show. Let's say someone is out there, they're listening, they are convinced that they do need to, in fact, start investing their money. How would you encourage someone to go ahead and get started if that's not something that they've done yet?
Yep. So first things first, we are. I'm assuming that they have taken care of their personal finances first. So I'm assuming that they've paid down all their high interest debt, that they have a 6-month emergency fund, that they have multiple sources of income, that they have their general personal finances are in order. From there, I'm going to say, well, do you have access to a retirement plan with an employer match? That is definitely the first thing to do. There's nothing like getting free money from your employer to put to work in the markets. So that's place one to go, especially if you're getting a company match. If beyond that, you still have extra capital, I would say open up a Roth IRA or an IRA, or depending on where you are in the world, in your country, there might be some other tax-blessed accounts that make it more attractive to invest. So I would look there, and depending on your personality, you can buy index funds in those, or you can even buy individual stocks in those. But if you've gone through all of that, you still have extra money, and you want to put that money in individual stocks in the markets, step one is to open up a brokerage account. There's lots of great brokers out there. They're by and large the same at this point. So there's Fidelity, there's Schwab, there's Robinhood. If you just want to be a mobile user, there's Public. So there's lots of places that you can open up a brokerage. Then if you're interested in individual stocks, the step one is always educate yourself. Always listen to podcasts if that's the medium that you like. Read books if that's the medium that you like. Watch YouTube videos if that's the medium that you like. But do the education necessary so that you can learn what attributes to look for in a good investment and what attributes to avoid in a good in an investment. And one exercise that I am a huge fan of is building an investing checklist for yourself. So make two lists: things I like, things I don't like. Make a big list of, if a company has this, I like it. If a company has this, I don't like it, for yourself. Then rank order them by which ones are most important to you and which ones are least important to you, and then apply some kind of scoring system to it. If that sounds overwhelming or confusing, brianfiraldi.com/checklist, there you can get free access to the one that I have, and just use that as a starting point. But then just start to do the research and go off some kind of a process for yourself for finding out if certain stocks are a match for your personality. But the worst thing to do is to just go on TikTok and see somebody is buying some stock and zero research behind it and saying, oh, that sounds good, I know what that is, and putting their money into it. Because that's a recipe for a disaster.
Yep, that's a recipe for losing the money that you want to grow into a nest egg for your future. So, Brian, man, thank you so much for coming on the show. And your book, I think, is a great place. You mentioned places people can turn to get educated. Why Does the Stock Market Go Up is a great resource. Your newsletter is a great resource. Where else can our listeners find out more about you?
I'm on all the social platforms. I'm on YouTube, if that's your thing. I'm on Twitter, if that's your thing. I'm on LinkedIn, if that's your thing. So you can find me there.
Nice. We'll link to all of that. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Matt and Joel, awesome to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, Matt, you got to love someone who, like Brian, who knows his stuff, but who has like a really well thought out system, who's done really well on it, but also says, guess what? This isn't necessarily for everyone. You have to think through all these things first.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
I feel like he could be the Pied Piper of like, follow me, do as I say, trying to lead this like, you know, individual stock investing cult. But he's avoiding that because he realized it's not necessarily this all-in strategy. And he's not even all in on that too. He's hedging his bets too. So I don't know. I really appreciate his philosophy. Glad we could have him on the show. What was your big takeaway from that combo?
Yeah, well, it was when he was basically gauging how we should know whether or not this is something we should consider. And if someone is listening and they decide, oh, I have the disposition to invest, for instance, in single stocks, what he said, and this is incredibly nuanced, but he said, you can take a more active approach with your investments. He didn't say go all in 100%. everything that you invest, including your retirement, should be in individual stocks, but you can take a more active approach. And that points to sort of that balance like you're talking about. And even Brian, who's done well, he still limits what he's actively investing to just his brokerage account. Mm-hmm. He's not going to mess with that when it comes to his retirement. And so we talk about that all the time. We do say for the vast majority of folks, and even him, even Brian said, for 99% of people, you're not even going to have the interest in doing this, let alone whether or not you're going to be good at it.
Yep.
But if you do have an interest, you can start dabbling a little bit and you can become a more active investor without not receiving Matt and Joel's blessing. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we want to have people on this show constantly who do things differently than we do, mm-hmm. but who have a rhyme and a reason and a methodology and some intelligence behind kind of their approach. So I think my big takeaway, though, was at the point where he basically said, no, short-term investing is gambling. And so he, even though he's investing in some of these individual stocks, he's thinking about these companies, investing in these companies as being a really long-term play. Oh, I think this company has room to run for the next 10 plus years. And I think it's really important. If you're going to get into investing, whether it's index funds or you're going to invest in individual stocks, you've got to have the long-term philosophy at play.
Yep.
Because in the short term, the stock market can look a little Las Vegas-like, right? It can drop 6% in a week or 22% in a year and then be back up. You know, there's all of these like daily and weekly and monthly machinations that you don't have to worry about and freak out about if you're investing for the long term. So that we had that question recently about day trading, Matt. That's why we're so against that, because it's not really investing. You're making gambling choices with money that's supposed to be investment money. So the stock market over the long haul goes up. In the short term, it's anybody's guess.
That's right, man. All right. This episode, you and I enjoyed Space Dream. This is a double dry hopped oat cream IPA. What were your thoughts?
This one was juicy and it was fruity, but within reason. Like it had.
Oh, I was going to say dry.
Oh, were you? Yeah. I thought it had some of those tropical fruit
tones. You and I are opposites.
In so many ways.
No, yeah. I mean, I would say it had like an herbal hoppiness as opposed to kind of like those tropical. I guess maybe because of the oats, I'm thinking like it's got like a very bready, kind of oatmeal-y. I'm thinking bread. We're making a whole lot of sourdough. Kate's making like different breads at home. And this is what it reminded me of that. It kind of had like a almost like a malty kind of.
Kate's bread like, tastes like this beer, bring me some.
Dude, is there anything better than a fresh sourdough loaf sliced,
nope.
toast, or not even toasted, like when it's warm like that?
Toss some butter on it.
Spread some butter on it.
Oh, that's the best.
But I did enjoy this one. To me, it had more of like a herbaliness going on as opposed to like a juicy fruit sort of hoppiness.
Yeah. But I love everything other half does.
So good. Glad you and I got to enjoy this one.
If they were an individual stock, I'd go all in.
Long on other half.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll make sure to link to all that Brian mentioned in the show notes up on the website at howtomoney.com. And buddy, that's going to be it for this one. So until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.